Space Oddity.
Welcome to our latest episode of our podcast of the CRC Refiguration of Spaces called Space Oddity. And my name is Jochen Kiebel. I'm a guest host for this episode of the podcast. And the reason for this is our wonderful guest that is a guest researcher at the CRC at this month. And his name is Dr. Makao Kitata.
Thank you for hosting me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Dr. Makao Kitata is coming to us from Nairobi in Kenya, and he is a researcher at the Department of Literature. And literature, although our CRC is a very interdisciplinary group of researchers, I think literature is something we do not yet cover. So I'm very glad that you are with us today. And if it comes to literature and spaces, I think it's a very crucial combination, especially if you imagine about romantic literature or literature of the European 19th century, that was very much affirmative to the nation state, for instance. So the idea and the spatial imaginations that are brought and expressed through literature eventually became socially and politically influenced. And I think this holds true also for the present time. And another interesting thing, particularly if we talk about colonial writers, just Rudyard Kipling, for instance, or Joseph Conrad, the combination between literature, space, coloniality may immediately come to your mind. And we get to know each other at the beginning of this year when me and my colleague Eva Korte were coming to Nairobi. And I was surprised, but amazed at the same time that in Kenya and East Africa, there's such a vivid literature scene. So many authors are coming up. And I'm very glad that we have an expert here with us, Makao. Maybe you can say a few words on your work and maybe also on the literature scene in Kenya and East Africa.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. My name is Makao Kitata again. I'm a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, Department of Literature. My research basically is on literature and geocultural studies. And literature, as you know, focuses on narrative analysis, but I go beyond that. I move from the text to field work to get primary data, research, and evaluate the connection between what is written and the practices amongst the people from which the literature is emerging. So that one has given me an opportunity to relate literature to the society, as it were, and it has enabled me to see things like how literature can be a source and an interpreter of national identity. It can be an interpreter of individual and community aspirations, and how literature can be linked to things like environmentalism. And from that, literature begins to have more sense. It begins to get much more relevant to the society in which it is coming from. And when you look at my publications, I've done some publications on things like how naming is imperative in Kenyan literature. And when you look at the question of names in Kenyan literature, you will ultimately have to go to the community and ask them what these names mean and whether that can be collaborated with the way that it has been used in literary texts. Things like dance and body expressions among people in Kenya. And as you know, dance is a way of communicating between peoples, and That one also forms a very important part of my research. You might know that literature has moved from the study of books to the study of popular culture. And that one has also given me an opportunity to see how literature relates to society. Moving through that direction, I've done some studies on Ngugi Thiong'o's writings and how they relate to architecture, urban space, and politics. And also I'm doing some research at the moment on home spaces and how they have been portrayed in Kenyan literature works, especially middle-class writings like that of Binyavanga Wainaina, who fits in very well within this kind of trajectory that my studies of literature in relation to society are taking.
Thank you for mentioning these two impressive authors, Binyavanga Wainaina and Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And from our earlier conversations, I know about these writings, but I just briefly want to go back to the aspect of naming. Because I know you did some research on naming and how naming is changing in Kenyan and East African novels. And if we think about the spaces, or if we just have a look on these names through a spatial lens, what are these names referring to? Is it typical African names, or is it names that come from Christianity? And what is what is the current development of naming, and how can it be described spatially?
Okay, thank you very much for coming back to that question of naming and its imperatives in Kenyan literature and Kenyan society in general. Naming is something that people take for granted. The name that a child is given when they are born is just taken as something for granted, but people, when doing it, they intentionally or unintentionally are recording some history, they are recording some sociology in it, and naming, especially in Kenya, can be consequential, as we all know, because it might determine whether you might get a job or not, or at a more personal level, it might determine whether you'll get a marriage partner or not because of just the name. So naming becomes something that is nuanced in the Kenyan society, and the way to detect these nuances of naming is through checking the way names have been used in literary texts. Most Kenyan writers are very careful, consciously or unconsciously, about what names they give to their characters. If you give a name to a character, that name carries implications about where this person comes from, their ethnic community, their biases. And that might either attract a reader of your book, or it might put off the reader immediately.
Mm-hmm. See.
So names become consequential. And in our general society as we live it, we might not see this. But in literature, because we are involved in discourse analysis and we are interested in looking at the nuances and the practices of putting names in works of art, that idea immediately emerges.
And you said that Kenyans and everybody who's familiar with the culture could name where a certain name is coming from. So a name refers to a place, to an ethnic community, and is consequential, as you said. But maybe you can give an answer how authors were dealing with this.
Okay, I'll give an example of how Ngugi wa Thiong'o uses names in A Grain of Wheat, something which I think I've written about somewhere. When Ngugi wa Thiong'o is writing A Grain of Wheat, he uses proper names of people and places to indicate where the action was taking place. This is a story about something that happened during that period when Kenya was struggling, fighting for independence. And by putting proper names of certain characters who come from central Kenya and mentioning the particular places in which action was taking place in central Kenya, those names index that place. Those names give more representational credibility to historical facts. Now, in the same book, the writer is also talking about other characters outside central Kenya who also participated in the struggle. For example, in one part of the book, Ngugi says there was also another actor who came from the lakeside, and he was also important in the struggle for independence. That actor is not mentioned, but people who know Kenya history, they know that Ngugi wanted to say Jaramogi Odinga Odinga. That one is not mentioned. So there is some nuanced level of inclusion and exclusion of people and characters in the struggle for independence, which is achieved through naming in literary works. And so one may think that naming or not naming is inconsequential, but it actually has consequences. Because after reading A Grain of Wheat, one may think that it is only people in central Kenya who participated in the struggle for independence in Kenya. The only places that were affected by the struggle for independence are just in central Kenya. And so that narrative has been created through literature. So literature sometimes has that power by simply using names or excluding names to create a certain narrative which the reader might take as truth, even though we know that fiction is fiction. But then we know that also literature draws from what is happening in society. And when a narrative is repeated over and over and over for a very long time, especially in literature, people tend to take it as truth. And it is not easy to sway people from that kind of perspective once they have received it from literature. Yeah.
So what he did is emphasizing the role of central Kenyans, namely the Kikuyu, and readers would immediately understand that he's talking about Kikuyu through the names, whereas he at the same time is silencing the role of other groups from the lake region, which is in West Kenya, by not naming them or by not mentioning these characters.
Oh yeah, that could be one of the effects. But then there are other writers who have written books about Kenya and the struggles that Kenyans go through, like Ken Walibora wrote a good book called Kufa Kuzikana, about the ethnic clashes in Kenya that took place after the 2007 elections. And in this book, he doesn't use proper names of Kenyans. He uses metaphorical names. Yeah, not proper names. And you can see the writer is struggling to sidestep ethnic politics.
Interesting.
Yeah, because the writer doesn't want to index a certain name of a particular community as the character who is fighting against this other character from another community through name. So in order to sidestep ethnic politics, he uses those metaphorical names. And at the end of the day, you wonder, what does that do to history? What does that do to history? That kind of creating an alternative narrative on top of the real narrative. So at the end, when you look at the way authors in Kenya use names in a bid to sidestep ethnic politics, that activity might serve them for purposes of getting readers, but it also works against them in the long run because of historical inaccuracies.
I see. And maybe we could also argue that by trying to avoid these names or give their the characters neutral names, by consciously silencing these aspects of ethnicity, of community and various other spaces, it is made relevant on another level, because readers would immediately know, okay, this is just fake names or names that do not have something to do with our reality.
Yes, at one level, the writer might get readers, the book might even be accepted for the Kenyan curriculum, because that is one of the policies of the government, mm-hmm. to minimize ethnic consciousness. Yes. The author might profit from that. But at another level, the text has used a real context, but failed to historicize it. And it has like evicted the real characters of that context and replaced the real characters with very, very fictional characters who might not carry the weight of history as literature is supposed to do. And one wonders why this is an obsession amongst Kenyan writers in particular. But then when you look back at the political realities of the country, you find that sometimes it is inevitable. Probably it is not happening in other countries, but that is a Kenyan trait, a Kenyan thing about names and their use in literature. People agonize about what name to give a character, and this is telling. Yeah, this tells you something about the way our country is constituted.
See.
Yeah.
Also a nice example of a spatial imagination carried through naming to imagine Kenya as an integrated place without emphasizing ethnic differences.
Yeah, right.
When we talk about names and that you could immediately trace them back to a certain place, let us go to the book we talked a lot about yet, and maybe you can introduce its author and the novel we talked about yet to our audience. It's Binyavanga Wainana, and his name is also special since it is Ugandan, and some part of the name is from Uganda. Am I right on this? Or maybe you can talk about his name and his book and on middle class housing, and which captures nicely all of our keywords from our project.
Yeah, this is an interesting text. Binyavanga Wainaina's "One Day I'll Write About This Place," this place that we were talking about a few minutes ago, this place called Kenya. But you can narrow it down to this place that I call home. And starting from his name, Binyavanga Wainaina, you can see that name is an intersection of many things at the same time. It is an intersection of ethnicity. It is an intersection of nationhood. It is a name that is very weighty and consequential. When you read the memoir, you'll find that one time actually Binyavanga went to the airport, was at the airport, and the person clearing him to board the plane noticed that this guy is called Binyavanga Wainaina. And the lady was concerned to know, what is Binyavanga? Why is he calling himself Binyavanga? Are you Kikuyu or what are you? And there was some uncomfortable exchange between the writer and the person who was trying to probe to know what this name was. Because it's a name that on one side tells you where the father comes from, but it doesn't tell you the complete story of the person, because Binyavanga is not a Kenyan way of naming. And so the text one day I'll write about these people brings out these issues very well. We know the traditional Kenyan home and way of naming can help people locate you. But if this is disrupted, the discomfort is also registered in the way other people relate with you. So the book itself is a source of such knowledge because it provides us with dimensions that show us the connections leading the home and the Kenyan society as a gendered construct. It also brings in ethnic ideas and practices like naming. And it also tells us about how the Kenyan identity is constructed. So the book itself shows you who Kenya and the home of the memoirist as a site for belonging. You see what it means to belong to a man-led biological entity, how to belong to an ethnic entity, how to belong to a certain geographical identifiable location in Kenya, how the home is arranged based on what resonates as traditional and naturalized notions of who a person is, who a member of an ethnic community is, who a member of a certain nation is. So these kind of identities that the book highlights have a way of forming hierarchies within the Kenyan society. And hierarchies are even more important. But you find that the text itself is also a site for challenging these hierarchies.
I think this is very interesting, and another nice example on how literature is not only describing places, even if the novel is called One Day I Write About This Place, and this place as a metaphor for Kenya. But at the same time, he kind of transforms or provides another narrative, another way of imagining Kenya, maybe. And the interesting thing with Binyavanga Wainaina is that his personal identity covers lots of different layers. His mother is a foreigner. He is also a gay man. He is coming from a middle class background, and he is so he has very various layers of his identity that he writes on. And maybe you can talk about these intersectional layers of his identity and to what extent they play a role in his work.
Oh, thank you very much for bringing out that question of intersectionality. The important thing about intersectionality in this text is that the intersections create hierarchies of which is high, which is low, which is favored, which is not favorable. And that's a way of looking at a society which is stable. A way of looking at a society that has been naturalized over time, but which this text disrupts by simply recording the memoir, by simply recording his experiences as a child all the way to his early adulthood. We find that the author is interested in exploring the hierarchies within those intersections and how they can be subverted and how they can be looked differently. So in a way, he's trying to do a refiguring of the space in which he finds himself in. First, the idea that Binyavanga Wainaina should be the son of maybe a Kikuyu and probably a fellow Kikuyu woman living in central Kenya, speaking Kikuyu, going to schools in his local area, and just following those hierarchies that have been set by society to become a complete human being at the end of the day, is completely destabilized in this text. Binyavanga Wainaina, as we have said, the father is Kenyan, the mother is not. Their home location is not in central Kenya, they are living in Nakuru. So geographically, it's like the identity starts getting refigured. It's like now this gets confusing. It confuses the person who looks at Kenya from one direction. And so progressively, as the memoir represents the spaces in which this young person is moving through in his process of going to school, getting educated, and learning about the world, the paradigm of intersectionality helps us to understand. It helps us to understand how this character is interpreting these spaces and how he is working to accommodate diverse meanings of gender, ethnicity, and nationhood as a character, but now within a society that has been programmed to think in other ways that are not naturalized in Kenyan society. So
thank you for bringing up the refiguration, yeah. Because obviously, as you put it nicely, he is destabilizing a certain grand narrative of the nation, a grand narrative of sexuality as heteronormativity and so on. And he's destabilizing it, and he's providing it providing another narrative and another geographical imagination that is not exclusively tied to the ethnic community or the nation state. At the same time, you talked about going to school. And I know from our previous conversations that another great author of Kenyan literature, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, did also write about his life. I think the novel In the House of the Interpreter. He writes on also from a autobiographical perspective. Am I right?
Yeah, you are right.
And he spends quite a lot of time of writing on going to school. Maybe we could talk about this aspects of going to the school and what spatial imaginations are attached to this.
Exactly. Thank you very much for coming to Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, in his memoir, In the House of the Interpreter, he presents us with an interpretation of space from a schoolboy perspective. The story of In the House of the Interpreter is about the personal story of Ngugi Wa Thiong'o when he went to school at Alliance Boys High School and how that formed a great part of his way of looking at the world. The memoir starts with an experience at the railway station at Limuru. The climax of the story is also an incident that takes place on the road when Ngugi and his fellow passengers are stopped by colonial police to check whether they have cards for tax payment. And the text also ends with an episode at the railway station again when Ngugi wa Thiong'o is moving to Uganda to Makerere University. And so when you read the memoir in the House of the Interpreter, you'll find that Ngugi is concerned with space and what it means to a person who is growing conscious of the colonial situation. The first paragraph of the book is about Ngugi remembering when he was going to school. He had been smuggled into a goods train. He had been smuggled into a goods train, and he was there looking at the world amongst workers' uniforms and workers' equipment. And so he sees his position in the colonial state as just part of the goods which the colonial government is extracting from the land. He is being extracted from Kamiretu, his small village, which was a creation of the process of villagization in Kenya. Mm-hmm. He is being extracted from there.
Sorry to interrupt you, but maybe for our audience, maybe you can explain something. What was villagization? I think that's very crucial.
Oh, sure. I may explain a bit about villagization and the formation of colonial villages for Kenyans during the colonial periods. Kamiretu is one of these villages that were formed by the colonial government to concentrate, to put Africans in one place so as to govern them. And the state of emergency and the Mau Mau were used as an excuse of evicting people from their lands and putting them together in very small concentrated villages where they could be, where it's like a concentration camp, a concentration village where your movements are closely monitored every day, where you become a colonial subject. And you never ever go back to your land. But it is also from these villages that the colonial government would pick people who are collaborating with it and reward them with pieces of land just adjacent to the village. And so it was a system of silencing the people, but also people showing the people what it would mean if you collaborated with the colonizer at the same time. And so there are many of these villages, but the one that I know, which I've studied, is Kamiretu in Limuru, where Ngugi starts his journey of schooling in the house of the interpreter. And he finds himself at the railway station going to Alliance High School, one of the biggest, the best school created for boys during the colonial times. And so Ngugi starts by interpreting the meaning of space in that text. He looks at the railway station, he looks at the goods train, and his position as a colonial subject, and he immediately sees himself as just someone who is being thrown amongst the goods and workmen. So he sees the carriage becomes not a space for traveling, but he looks at it now as a workspace. It's like a workscape. He sees himself as a subject in a workscape, not just a traveler to school. So later, when Ngugi has finished school and is working in Kiambu, he is traveling in a bus from Nairobi to Limuru when they are stopped. They are stopped by the colonial police, and they are being searched to see who is paying taxes and who is not paying taxes. Ngugi, because he is just a schoolboy who is about to go to Alliance, of course, becomes a victim, because they say the policeman says this boy is resisting arrest, which is false, of course. They put him to jail. He goes through an ordeal over the weekend and is released the following week. And the next significant part of the memoir is when Ngugi wa Thiong'o is in a second-class train carriage going to Uganda. That is how the memoir ends. So we can see the beginning, the climax, and the conclusion of this memoir as events taking place on colonial roads and colonial spaces, and Ngugi's ability to interpret his colonial experience through looking at the spaces he is in.
Yeah. And I think it quite remarkably shows how closely linked and interwoven his own life story is with a colonial spatial structure. But as I also know from our previous conversations, Ngugi wa Thiong'o was very active in central Kenya. And so if we see these in this post-colonial literature, how the colonial spatial structure is described, at the same time, these post-colonial writers like Ngugi wa Thiong'o especially were also very active. And I know that there was a theater in central Kenya, and I just recently saw, and I knew from our conversations, that one of his plays was now very, just a 1 year ago, or just a very, very recently, was again shown at the National Theater of Kenya in Nairobi. And so I think in terms of the refiguration, this could be also very interesting to see how these colonial spatial structures still shape the colonial, the Kenyan society. But on the other hand, of course, there is a post-colonial intent to destabilize, to subvert, to transform these things. And I know that also you are very active in reconstituting or reconstructing this very famous theater where Ngugi wa Thiong'o was also very active in central Kenya. Maybe you can tell us something about this.
Yeah, thank you for going back to Ngugi wa Thiong'o and theater. Ngugi wa Thiong'o started together with the Kamiruthu communities. He started the Kamiruthu Theater in the late 70s. And when you go to the place where that theater was, you'll find there is a polytechnic, because the theater was destroyed by the government because the government thought it was a threat. That is, the Kenyatta government thought that it was a threat to the policies of the government at the time. So they knocked it down, and Ngugi ran away to exile. And the space that was previously used for the theater was used now to build a polytechnic. There's a polytechnic there, and it's like there hasn't been theater activity ever since. But the people who participated in the play are still around, and that spirit of Ngugi wa Thiong'o and the Kamiruthu Theatre is still alive, and people are now performing the plays at the National Theatre. There are also some groups which are performing the same play to the community. I know of one. I talked to some of them recently. The connection between space and literature can actually be tied closely to the development of this open-air theater that Ngugi created in Kamiruthu. In my research, I went back to Alliance High School, where Ngugi went to school, and I looked at the theater spaces that have been preserved since the colonial times. And I could see the structure of the theater where boys used to watch their plays. And it somehow resembles the open-air theater that Ngugi Ngugi built in Kamiresu. The idea of having seats around a stage, you know, and I got intrigued that probably by going to school, Ngugi also learned something about how to put up a theater space and how to involve the audience and the community in the theater. And so this kind of linkages between what Ngugi learned in school and what Ngugi did in the community becomes an important link in the way space has been redefined and the way space is viewed in Kenya ever since the colonial encounter between the British and the Kenyans in the early part of the 20th century. So that theater space that Ngugi created, which was demolished, and the idea that it is coming back to the people, that people are now reenacting those plays, tells you that there is something cyclic about the way people identify with space, regardless of how hard the authorities push them away from that kind of identification. Yeah.
Thank you very much for just explaining all these very interesting spatial aspects of literature and how it may become socially and politically influential. And so what I take out of this is that at the moment in Kenya, I think there is a very vivid scene in literature, and it may also lead that places are not only described but also refigured. And with this, I thank you once again for that very nice conversation. It's great that you still stay with us, and we will definitely continue our conversation at some point. And
thank you for hosting me.